Good morning, everybody. Today we have a visitor, Bruce Damer, who's originally from Canada but now lives in California, Silicon Valley, near Silicon Valley. And he's come to visit us today, the whole day, and also probably this evening. If any of you have interest in going out later, we'll have some plans. Don't know what they are, but it'll be fun.
I've heard in advance of the giraffe beer, so...
Oh, we're going out for giraffe beer tonight. And I met Bruce recently, just last week or so, when we were in London at this systems architecture conference, and we were talking quite a bit in the pub and other places about using computers to understand something about emergent phenomena, and using computers to model different kinds of self-organization, self-assembly of molecules. And Bruce has some ideas about this, how to do this, and that's his experiences in doing lots of modeling, as you will hear. And so he's here to tell us about what he is interested in doing, and also I think is interested in some feedback on what we think about his projects. So thank you for coming, Bruce.
You're welcome. So I'm going to actually, based on Martin's prompt, and then give you a bit more of a background on me and why I'm doing this. It goes back about 25 or 30 years. Thousands of years. So the title of the talk is The Evil Grid, Laying the Foundations for an Artificial Origin of Life, and hopefully we'll understand what that means at the end. Just a bit of my background, creative and research background. When I was a teenager, I was drawing virtual worlds, mainly being extremely bored in school. Who isn't? I'm a visual thinker, so this is the kind of thing that I was doing while I should have been doing my work.
These are yours?
Yeah. In the 80s, I finally made it off to college. And one of the first visions I had was, I was very interested in space from a very young age. I saw the moon landing and Neil Armstrong and whatnot. I was 7 years old at the time. I guess most of you didn't see that. I'm just getting old. So I always had an interest in space, and it always struck me that if you're going to do serious things on the moon, serious infrastructure, you need to make self-reproducing mechanisms and robotics. And I learned later how hard, nearly impossible this is, and I'll explain a bit more. I went to graduate school at University of Southern California in 1985, and as usual, I'm too soon for things. I got a VAX 750, that was my machine, on it with a Tektronix scope, and I was building artificial life software in 1985. Based on reading von Neumann's book, because I couldn't find anything else. I mean, I searched the online system, I searched Usenet and everything, there was just nothing. And it was a couple of years before the first Artificial Life Conference, so of course I'm too soon, as usual. And no one understands what I'm talking about. It was interesting work. So I finished my master's degree with the intent to go on to do the PhD, but I just really found that there was no understanding what I was talking about by the faculty, there was not enough computing power to do what I wanted to do. So I thought, I'm going to have to wait. So I went on in the late 80s, joined Xerox and a small startup called Elixir, and did something else I dreamed of doing. In 1981, I saw the cover of a magazine that showed a graphical interface. And this is long before the Macintosh and the Lisa. This is the Xerox Star. And I got in the late 80s to write an operating system. So I wrote this. This is basically the Xerox Star interface for PCs. I wrote from scratch. Don't do this at home. All the pull-down menus, every pixel, everything like that. So that got me very familiar with two-dimensional GUIs. This is just after the Mac came out and just before Windows. About that time, I started to, and this is one of my cartoons, I started collecting vintage computer hardware because I was around Xerox PARC and whatnot and realized that they were throwing away all their heritage and they weren't saving it. So I started collecting this hardware, and that today grew into a huge collection called the Digibarn, which is in my barn in the near Silicon Valley. This is Steve Wozniak. He came over one day and he was missing his old girlfriend. And and this is, of course, the Star. This is the first portable musical computer. This is the Xerox collection. That's a machine from Lincoln Laboratory in 1962 that we got working. That's a Cray supercomputer. That, don't ask how I got that. There's about 500 machines there. So I'm tracking the entire emergence of digital computing and digital space, I call. That's why I call the company Digital Space. And it's partly through this collection. This is just a part-time thing, but there's 500 machines there now. It's a crazy project. In the mid-90s, I had sort of foreseen the rise of virtual worlds, and I formed a nonprofit organization in the early to mid-90s that was going to be the umbrella organization. And as these projects came online, I got everybody together. So, for example, this is all the avatars from the different technologies of the mid-90s. And I wrote a book about it. I held conferences about it. I brought all the universities and industrial partners together to create the avatar medium, help define new terminology, help define the features for the platforms. And that the avatar environments, by the dot-com crash, they had the first early adopter platforms had crashed, and then it came back. It was Second Life, things like that. So it was very interesting because this is the new medium. Is that my water there? I think it is. Great. A little side story here. In 1994, I drove to the Santa Fe Institute, and they were just moving into the new Hilltop place. If you guys have been there, the new Hilltop place. I went in, and there was Chris Langton in a full leg cast, having broken his leg falling out. He's broken almost every bone in his body. I don't know if you know his history from skydiving to, you know, building a treehouse for his kid. Of course, he breaks his leg in two places. This is just the way Chris was. So he said, "I need help." I said, "What do you mean? I need to be driven around." I said, "I'll drive you around. I can talk to you if I drive you around." So we talked about virtual worlds. It was at that time I was predicting that they would come, and I had this idea that the rise of virtual worlds would lead to technologies for artificial life experimentation through cyberspace, and that was the general direction. And a couple of years later at ALIVE 6, I met him again, and I finally got him hooked into these worlds, and he got pretty hooked on them. So I've since decided that places like Second Life are really poor environments for artificial life or emergent phenomena experiments because it's just the computing cycles are not there. It's all clocked to the user. You just can't get enough compute out of them. But they're impressive places nonetheless. This is Alpha World in the late 1996. It was over 10 million objects the users put down. This is sort of looking from above. So even in that early period, it was substantial spaces were being built by users. And what I also did was I invented and pioneered this idea of holding large events in virtual worlds. So we held the Avatars cyber conferences. Several thousand people at each event every year. And we intended things like meeting rooms that were assembled by databases and run by bots and the whole thing. Because I was still very interested in life-like simulation, I kept doing projects, and I formed an organization called biota.org, and I have a couple of CDs of audio, our podcast here, if somebody's interested into. You can also get them online. But Biota was an idea that you could bring artificial life, if you will, or bio-inspired things into virtual worlds. And so in 1997, we went to SIGGRAPH with this installation called Nerve Garden, where we grew L-system plants in the shared garden, and it was all hosted online. So that was our first project in Biota. Something relevant to Denmark, this was the first actual virtual world used with a company. It was IHI Insurance in Copenhagen in 1998, so I thought I'd throw that up for. This is a doctor, it's an actual doctor who will sit there and wait for people to come in and ask health insurance questions. This is for Danes that are living abroad. So it was an experiment we did in 98. Gradually, our our virtual world avatars experiments kept bringing in space themes. So this is the Avatars 99 and 2000 conference spaces. This is the Avatars 2000, there's me on the screen. Avatars 2001, a cyberspace odyssey, of course. We ripped off Stanley Kubrick's film. And that led to this event, which was quite fascinating. In the summer of 1999, I had met Rusty Schweikart, and this is Rusty in orbit in 1969. And I remember seeing this launch on TV and seeing pictures of the astronauts, and one of them had red hair. He's got a red helmet. And they tested all the lunar landing hardware in orbit during this mission in March of 69. This is me training Rusty in the spring of 1999 how to navigate in an avatar world and navigate in and out of the same hatch that he's coming here for in orbit in 1969. And this is him today. So there he is on the mission. There he is today. Really nice guy. So what we did was we basically built a moonwalk experience world with the University of Cincinnati, actually built it, and reenacted the landing on the moon. This is the summer of 99, it's the 30th anniversary. So there's people coming down in world in their avatars. And NASA saw this. And finally, after years of being a fan of space, I finally got an inroad. NASA said, come and do a presentation like I'm doing here at NASA Ames Research Center. And they started hiring us. And basically for the last 10 years or so, they've provided, I think, 25 projects so far for digital space for my company to build, to bring virtual environments and virtual worlds into NASA. And I'm going to sort of show you a few of these projects. One of the biggest success stories in NASA is teleoperations. You know, you hear about the space station and the shuttle and everything, and that's very expensive, time-consuming, and risky. Most of the science that NASA has done has been done with teleoperated missions, whether it be the Hubble Space Telescope or Mars Exploration Rover. So that's the giant success story. So I focused a lot of our work on enabling teleoperations in the solar system. This is a forgotten project from the early to mid-70s, the Lunokhod landers that the Soviet Union put on the moon and ran for months and months, and they went for tens of kilometers in the lunar day-night cycle, which is a severe temperature fluctuation. And this is this fellow's a general now. He's retired, but here he is operating the Lunokhod and looking at the camera, so just with a joystick, with a three-second delay. It was an amazing mission that has been forgotten. The most famous teleoperated surface mission, of course, is the Mars Exploration Rover. And the height of this camera is actually the walking height of the human. So this is about just over 5 inches. So this is when you're in mission control and you're looking out the mass cam, you can map it to your own body. That's how they did that on purpose. So it's like you're an avatar on Mars, in effect, when you're running the MIR rover. Michael Sims, who's a colleague of mine, basically said, after MIR, Mars has become a place. It's a place that's familiar to people. And some views from the mass cam here. It's very familiar spots, and they've gone, you know, for many kilometers at this point, gradually running out of juice. So what we did for Jet Propulsion Lab was this project called Drive on Mars, and it was a public outreach project for kids to use these simulated Mars rovers. And this is where we first put in really detailed physics, because unless you have good physics, you can't have good, you don't have a good field. We used the Havok physics engine for this project. This was about 5 years ago. We've been invited since then on numerous occasions to help NASA with mission design concepts. So this is a possible robotic mission which would go down a crater slope. And these are very, very steep slopes. This is a shot from Apollo 15. And go into these dark regions that are always dark and look for water ice. And possibly there's water ice in the lunar south polar craters like Shackleton that has been deposited by comet impacts. When a comet hits the moon or any kind of an icy object, you tend to get stuff, a plume that forms, and then the stuff comes back down And if the theory is if it fell into this region, it wouldn't boil off. It would just layer, just like you see in dirty glaciers. My friend Jack Schmidt, who's on the moon in 1972, doesn't believe that they'll find water ice. There's a mission flying this year that's going to actually send an impactor into one of the shadow regions and blow a plume out that they'll fly through. I think it's in about 3 months.
So this is the typical
NASA mission design process. It happens in a place like Team X at JPL, and there's workstations for different parts of the mission, and you're basically locked in a room for 4 or 5 days and fed government food until you finish your work. So there's somebody working on propulsion, someone works on mass, somebody works on budget, someone works on booster package or science instruments. This is the CAD workstation. We've been a part of this where they'll say, we want to go beyond CAD, we want to actually do a drivable simulation that everybody can look at, because it's very hard when you're only working with spreadsheets, which is what most of them are, to understand the whole mission. So this is an example of the Crater Drill Explorer that we did for JPL, or it was actually for the whole of NASA. And I'm going to show you a little bit of... It takes a bit of time to adjust with this projector. Apologies. So this is driven in with a joystick in real time. This suspension is designed to do. They were able to determine from, this is a radiator to radiate heat, they were able to determine that they needed a much better braking system because the vehicle would slide sideways. And it would also heat up if the sun angle was right on the back of it. It would cause extra thermal load because this would be covered with dust. It would coat itself with dust. It just happens. The moon's a really hard place to operate. It really is. Now it takes a bit of time to adjust. Another mission that's interesting from a design perspective is we were asked for a headquarters study in 2007. The headquarters wanted to know how could we actually send a human crew to an asteroid. If you go back to the moon and you want to go to Mars, but actually an intermediate mission is an asteroid mission where an asteroid is coming by the Earth and there's several candidates. You go out about 60 days, rendezvous and dock with it. Basically, you're not really landing in the sense that the gravity is so low. And then you ride it toward the Earth and you get off and you come home. And NEOs, or near Earth objects as they're called, or asteroids, are fascinating places. There's good science to be done there. There's a tremendous amount of early primordial solar system material that you don't find on the moon. And possibly the future of the space program will require us to go out and mine asteroids and comets. That's the only way we can actually produce a sustainable space program. So these are my scribbles from a couple of years ago. And this was the resulting mission. We were allowed to release the information to the press, and it was picked up by a lot of news outlets. And so this is the mission's quite interesting. This is the Constellation hardware, which they're designing and building now to go back to the moon. But I designed... this pressure module plus this ring of airbags with penetrometers and EVA and ability to get out or to teleoperate in case you don't want to go outside. And of course you can see they're kind of scuba diving here because it's so ultra low gravity. It may look like the lunar surface, but it's not. Now this might be a 300 meter asteroid. They're all rotating and hey. Oh, you need a chair. Oh, careful. So this was a very interesting mission design. I'll run a bit of a movie. We were asked to do a render treatment of this. And this is macro scale physics. What you guys work on is extreme micro scale physics, but this is sort of extreme macro scale. So here we are, we're rotating what's called NSAM down, or NEO surface access module, and you'll see how you're coming in. It kind of looks like the lunar landing, but it's not because you have very low gravity. You're trying to find a place that is secure on the surface. So these airbags give you a soft touch landing. The penetrometers go in to find out if the surface is actually crumbling. It doesn't have any load bearing capacity. And then you've got to figure out how to stay upright. So you're firing your jets. So you try to fire out a tether or an anchor system to get any kind of a pull on the surface. And this is debatable whether this would work. A lot of my rock climber friends question it. But if you can somehow tie yourself down, then you can do these spacewalks. And you need to use handholds. And of course you plant the obligatory flag, but it's hopefully a flag of the Earth rather than just one country. Or of the funding partners. Oh, Canada's in there twice, that's a good thing. I'm Canadian. Yeah. So that's the typical design that I'll do for NASA on these missions. Now the same Rusty Schweikart, the Apollo 9 astronaut that you saw earlier, got in touch with me about 2 years ago and said, I'm heading up an effort to promote to the world's governments that we need to have missions to go out to threatening or questionable asteroids and track them and look at a pilot mission to shift their orbits. Now, the story behind this is really interesting. My friend Pete Hutt, who's at the Institute for Advanced Study, was walking along in New York, and his cell phone rang, and he almost doesn't like cell phones. He never answers it, but for some reason, he took it out of his pocket and answered it, and it was Ed Liu calling from space, calling from the International Space Station. Ed had been looking out the window, and in a very, very rare spare moment of discontemplation, because you're very busy, you work like crazy up there, and he had figured out in his head how to do asteroid gravity tractor and gravity towing. He figured the math out that it was actually possible. And he was so excited, he called, got permission, got routed through JSC and got the call through. And so what happened was then Pete contacted Rusty Schweikart, who founded an organization called the B612 Foundation, so named after the little print, the petit prince, you know, with the moons. And Rusty's whole mission in the last 10 years has been to raise the awareness that we need to do something about the threat of these things and or their resource sources for space programs. So he said, so they actually worked it out, and JPL did all the calculations to show that if you flew a spacecraft under continuous propulsion, like this has got little ion jets, this might be ESA Smart 1 mission to the moon. If you flew it either ahead or behind the near-Earth object, for several years kept it in this gravity box region, they call it, you will shift the orbit of something that weighs hundreds of millions of tons, 100 million tons. You will shift it, and the calculations for Apophis, which is a close approaching asteroid, will close approach the Earth in 2029, is you could move it 100 kilometers in 3 years with this solution. So what we did, what Rusty said, there's a possibility of using an impactor to impart a little bit of momentum, but it's very tricky because the things are rotating, and where do you impact it? And we've impacted comets now. I don't know, they didn't do an orbital determination for that impact. But anything you can do, so this was done last year. This year, we're working on, they're rushing to finish the space station before they cancel the shuttle program, which is supposed to be next year. I don't think it's going to happen. And one other area we've done modeling for NASA is in really detailed spacewalk simulations. So this is actually the end one bit of the space station. It's a lot bigger than people think. And we recently produced, I could show it later if anyone's interested. This is it's on NASA.gov. You can download it and run it. It's the complete Hubble servicing mission spacewalk simulations, all compressed into one canonical spacewalk. So you can become the astronaut, and this is there replacing the wide field camera. This is the astronaut on the Canadarm2 who's pulled out the wide field camera, is putting it in a parking position, he's gonna go get the new one. And we modeled the entire mission from video, from training in the swimming pool in Houston. So that's my space career. onto the evil grid. So back visiting, having these ideas in the early 80s, drawing virtual worlds in my mind and on paper, visiting Chris Langton, or doing virtual world artificial life things on the VAX at USC in 1985 and finding out nobody understood what I was doing, there was no field. I delayed doing any further work until meeting Chris Langton in 1994 at SFI, driving him around in his leg cast and then selling him on the idea that virtual worlds were coming to the internet. I went on to form BIOTA, which had the three BIOTA conferences, which had, the reason I did that was so that I could actually meet all these wonderful people. So we had Richard Dawkins and Douglas Adams and Carl Sims and Tom Rain, all these people at the conferences, so that later, when I went to do this project, I would have a connection with all these people and understand what they were working on. So I finally decided in 2007, having done 25 projects for NASA and all this work, that I was going to go back to school, and I found a university in London that had an external for ancient people like me, late model PhD, I call it, that where I could take the original proposal I had from 1985, cycle through all of this 20-some years of work, and go back and start working on it again. This time, because I have a team and I have funding and I have colleagues and whatnot, it might work. So that's a bit of a quick background. So soft artificial life, and I'm using Mark Bedeau's terminology because I think it really fits. You know, we had him on the BIOTA podcast, I think, a month ago, and it was wonderful to hear his overview of how things have evolved and where they're going. This is SFI, there's Chris. And I thought I would just if you haven't seen this, it's very inspiring. Have you all seen the Carl Sims work, the thinking machines work? Somebody's not nodding.
Maybe not everybody.
I think it's inspiring. I mean, it was inspiring to a whole generation of people. So that was inspiring to a whole generation. In fact, Chris, they had just installed Mosaic on their summer workstations at SFI when I was there in the summer of 94, and they were downloading this MPEG. And when Thinking Machines, the company that sponsored the research, was going out of business, I actually punched through their firewall and took all of these videos, because they were all going to disappear from Carl's site, and hosted them for about 5 years to keep them running, at least as fossil relics, until Carl could actually get his own site up and formed his company. So that was kind of an interesting thing to do. Spore, which was launched last year, designed by Will Wright, isn't artificial life, and he said that, of course, but it probably will interest a generation in bio-inspired simulation, because we know that because SimCity in the early 90s really did. It created a generation of sort of sysop nerds to understand all the connections between servers and pages and whatnot. So that's something to think about. So I mentioned the BIOTA conference series. I grew up only a couple of, maybe 4 hours, 3 hours drive from the Burgess Shale in British Columbia. We always knew about it as kids. We knew that there were crazy people up on the mountainside, you know, finding crazier fossils. But by the mid-90s, I read Stephen Jay Gould's book, Wonderful Life and everything, and it occurred to me that what BIOTA, the organization, should do is hold a conference at the Burgess Shale. And I knew, having been born there and hiked all those mountains, I knew that we could probably get people up there. So I went up there in the winter, went up there when there was no bear season, hiked up there, met the people, and arranged for 60 people to climb up there, which wasn't that difficult because there's actually a fairly prepared path. But it is about, you're going up 2,000 meters. Which is a lot for overweight paleontologists who just sit in front of computers in Chicago. And so I then created the Digital Burgess Conference in 1997, which was held at the Banff Center. And again, it was kind of a little bit of a takeoff on artificial life, but more visionary exploration. That was the purpose of that series. And then I invited Richard Dawkins and Douglas Adams, who couldn't come due to a family emergency, but came to this next conference. But Carl Sims came, Tom Ray came, paleontologists came, scientists, computer scientists, writers. It was quite an event. And we did we did go up to the Burgess Shale, and this is what it looks like. This is Tom Ray, and this is the chief paleontologist who was in charge of the field season up there. And this is an actual fossil. It's a soft body preserved critter with, where you can actually see what its last meal was. It's an amazing preservation. These are 535 million years ago, Cambrian fossils. No bones yet in this part of the fossil record, and yet these were preserved. It's very interesting geologically how that happened. But this entire, this is about a city block long now that's been excavated, and virtually every piece of shale has creatures, has fossils on it. And they're throwing them away for the most part. Oh, it's another Otoia, it's another Wewaxia, toss that. You're not allowed to take any of them or you're prosecuted for poaching. Poaching a half a billion year old animal. But so we took the group up there to launch the Biota conference series. This is Biota 2 in Cambridge, very different environment. This is Richard Dawkins doing his talk there. So it was, this was more focused on emergence in sort of in the heart of A-life, actually. There's a lot of roboticists there. There were robotics. This is at Magdalen College, Cambridge. He gave us umbrellas, souvenir umbrellas. So a different type of a conference. In 99, Digital Biota 3 was at San Jose State, and it was hosted by Rudy Rucker and Drew Sterling, and they're visionary kind of science fiction writers. We thought that would be a... And Game Developers King. And then 2004, Digital Biota 4 was at the North American Paleontological Convention. And actually, I think that the International Society of Artificial Life was being founded at that time, so I met some people. We're planning Digital Biota 5, and that will be, it was going to be at Shark Bay, at Hamlin Pool, the stromatolite locations, and I even had set up Paul Davies to take us out there. But then the dot-com crash happened, and we just couldn't raise any sponsorship. But Digital Biota 5 may be on for next year, certainly not when artificial life is held here. We make sure that, and we're not sure on the location, but the theme is probably going to be design, elements of design and emergence. Of course, you are all here embodying the wet artificial life movement that Mark has given it, we're classified everyone into. This is some of the Bartlett School's renderings. I don't know if you showed them to the group yet.
Some people saw it, not everyone.
It's not everyone. I just grabbed one, just to sort of bring the Bartlett in here. Everything else you're familiar with. When I actually look at physical things, which is kind of rare, and I look in something like this, it just boggles my mind how much computation is going on. It's almost an undoable problem to simulate this kind of thing, but there may be methods. So the PhD, after all this 23 years of in-between stuff with virtual worlds, the PhD subject that finally crystallized for me is in this book, which was published a couple of months ago, and it's a collection of a very large collection of essays. It was published for Darwin's birthday. It's called Divine Action and Natural Selection. There's, I think, 35 authors here. It's a wonderful book. It's actually a head-to-head dialogue between scientists. There's a cardinal of the Vatican who's the head of the Vatican Observatory. There's a Nobel Prize laureate for people like Seth Shostak from the SETI Institute. There's Muslim fundamentalists from Turkey. There's American fundamentalist evangelicals writing here. It's really quite amazing. I wrote a chapter called The God Detector, which I'll leave you to guess what that's about. The co-editor of this book, Richard Gordon, wrote about Hoyle's challenge. You know about Fred Hoyle's comment about 25 years ago that junkyard science, he called it, where, you know, would a tornado go through a junkyard and assemble a 747, etc. And so what emerged out of this book project was Dr. Gordon's challenge, could artificial life spontaneously arise from artificial non-life, and does that shed light on the origins of life from non-life? And then it becomes a definitional problem, because what is artificial life? What is artificial non-life? after meeting Richard Dawkins at our second Biota conference, I went to Oxford to have tea in his drawing room, which is quite an amazing thing because you're served tea. His wife, she was the actress who played on Doctor Who. She was the assistant because Douglas Adams had introduced them on the set of Doctor Who, and they got married. And so she's this wonderful woman who comes out and gives you tea. And I asked Richard how he felt about the artificial life field since we had the conference in Cambridge. And he actually was focused on things that became the God Delusion Project later. He was focused on, I think it was a daughter-in-law that was being taken away at the age of 12 to a Catholic convent, and he was just totally terrified of what would be put into her mind and how she would be programmed, basically. And he felt it was child abuse. No, and that's what comes out in the book. But I explained to him the idea of this idea framed in terms of a sort of an annual competition where you would have people try to build lifelike systems that emerge without people messing around with them. And he was very interested in being involved and actually to create the categories of what you thought of a living system. I know that a lot was defined in A-Life 2. It's a very crisp definition there. But Dawkins was actually very interested, and it surprised me because he wasn't, since the biomorphs, I don't think he's really looked at this that much. But I'm going to go back to him to see if he's wants, now that he's retired, I'm going to see if he wants to be involved in this in some way. So in order to sort of explain to myself what this was about and also generate interest, I had one of our NASA animators create a short movie, which I'll show you, and vision for the evil grid, really a thought experiment of what could happen in a whimsical way sometime in the 21st century if this kind of thing works. And again, it's very whimsical. As in NASA speak, we call it notional. Well, there you have it. And this is up on YouTube, and it's had a few hundred views so far, but it's basically a provocative but lighthearted look at this concept of linking soft and wet artificial life somewhere down the road. We're working on a couple more variants, but I'll keep that as a surprise. So that's not the subject, really, what I'm coming to talk to you about today, because that's too large of a piece of work to do in a PhD, for one thing. And really, what it comes down to, in looking at all the systems that have been built by amateurs and by academics over the last 20-some years, one of the comments that I go back to is, let me tell you a precursor story. I'm a visitor at the Institute for Advanced Study, which is this funny institute in little weird brick buildings in the woods in New Jersey. But it's an interesting group of people. And in fact, I'm going there in a couple of weeks, going back there in a couple of weeks to try to talk to Freeman Dyson. But it turns out that at the Institute was founded in 1931-32, it took in a lot of people from Nazi Germany, including Albert Einstein, during the war. And it's really pure research. There's a math department, there's an economics department, physics department, history department. But in 1946, John von Neumann, right after World War II, and there's all these wonderful people released from government projects in places like Bletchley Park, appears at the Institute and is able to get funding from the Atomic Energy Commission to build a really rocking digital computer. And this is the era where everybody's saying, digital computers, they seem to have worked somehow, and we should all design our own. Now, what von Neumann did, he was a brilliant architect. He got a significant amount of funding, but the Institute didn't really do laboratory things. They didn't build anything. So in order to get this project done, they had to put it in this little hastily built brick building far away from Fulton Hall, where no one would notice, and the trustees sort of put up with this. And then all these people would work sort of 24 hours a day assembling this machine, which was 2,600 valves or vacuum tubes, 40 Williams tubes, which are these cathode ray tubes for fast storage, and a drum system for memory, and a modified IBM punch card system to drive the thing. And that actually became the basis of IBM's entry into the computer market. People don't know that. But this machine was amazing. It was truly it was the first open source hardware project as well, because von Neumann, every quarter, if you set your name and address in and seemed like a valid person who might actually use this information, they would send you their quarterly reports, which would say, here's the progress on the design of the Institute for Advanced Studies computer, and feel free to use any of this you want. And so all these groups sprang up, that were springing up at universities anyway, and they were saying, let's build a digital computer. They'd get these reports and realize this guy had figured it all out already and was building it. So they were all racing to build their own von Neumann machines. They knew that John was building his machine at the Institute, and some of them said, we're going to get ours up first. But they adopted the architecture of registers and cache memory and serial yet parallel processing and external memories that are slower, etc. was adopted en masse. And this is the basis for all of machines of today, is because of this open source hardware philosophy. In 1951, the IAS machine, it never got a name other than the Institute for Advanced Studies machine, it came live. This is all in George Dyson's wonderful book, Darwin Among the Machines, by the way, if you want to read the detailed history. But so the Atomic Energy Commission people arrived. They load up a program, important program for them. They funded the project. It ran for 60 days, 24 hours a day. This was a huge achievement at that time, when the mean time to failure for, I'm telling them all this because I have a big, giant vintage computer collection in my barn, and I'm really passionate about these kind of things. But mean time to failure on most systems then was about 5 minutes. So for this machine to run 60 days in a row on heavy duties engineering scientific calculation was a huge achievement, and it proved that digital computing was possible for science and every other application. And that was the calculation for the Mike test of the super, or the hydrogen bomb that blew away an atoll in the South Pacific. So that was the first, that was the funder. And the calculations allowed them to build the hydrogen bomb. A year and a half later, a strange fellow, a self-made, at least a financially independent researcher named Niels Barricelli, now that's a combination of Norwegian and Italian, but this guy was, arrived at the Institute as a visitor, kind of like me, got himself embedded into the von Neumann project, and he built what he called the numerical symbioorganisms project, which was to take ideas of symbiogenesis, which were popular at the time, this is the early 50s, this is before Margulis, and put them to the test in this machine. And he filled the entire 5K with basically a digital universe that was continuous, that the things that would reach the boundaries would go to the other side, and used up every possible resource in the IAS machine, ran all the Williams tubes, and built what basically was Tierra. It's amazing. And George Dyson actually found materials on this in the basement, the Institute, including the punch cards and all the notes, put this back together, talked to his father, Freeman, about what was going on, and said, oh yes, this inspired my ideas on the dual origins of life in the 50s. This is this Barricelli stuff. And he's been kind of forgotten or not really covered in the histories. And it turns out that his algorithms showed, they showed natural selection, they showed the emergence of viruses in the system, very much like Tierra, but on the most basic, primitive, first digital computer. Roll this forward to at Digital Burgess Conference, Tom Ray was saying, yes, it's all well and good with Tierra, but they always seem to reach a threshold where they don't, complexity stops, there's not any more emergence. And so what I would like to do, and you can tell me if I'm mad, I've already been declared mad by some people at University College London, is to try to build a simulator that can push beyond the complexity plateaus that we're seeing in all these earlier systems. And I think, just intuitively, and tell me I'm mad again, that it's because the physics is too poor in the simulations, that they're not generating the self-organization, the complex self-organization. And that you need to have, not only do you need to have very rich physics and high performance to have a lot of particles, a lot of objects like you have in chemistry, but you need to be able to do this other thing, which is this kind of autopoietic searching for self-organization. So consider a simulation where you have artificial gravity and artificial heat sources and sinks and artificial Brownian motion and all the kinds of things that, that you would have, but you have a lot of them. But they're on sliders. You can vary them very finely. And as a result, you would build this simulation to run on a grid, maybe through the Berkeley network, through the Boink network, because I know one of the developers of that, so that you can get a couple of million computers running it, like SETI at home, etc. But the simulation would be somehow tracking emergent phenomena or self-organization in dumps. Dumps would be coming out so that you're not sampling, you're not biasing the experiment, so that the simulator is always shoring a dump out somewhere and it's being analyzed offline and you're looking for patterns in space and time. You're looking for things that are going on. You're not going to see it visually because you just can't afford to render this. It's be too large anyway. It'll clock it down too much. And then if you do see something, you can the simulation can go back and focus on those, tweaking those parameters a little bit to see if you get a little bit more self-organization. So it's crawling forward in the space, looking for a set of starting physics parameters and properties that will generate more self-organization. And really that's the extent of what I'm interested for this PhD research in showing that either building a prototype, and I do have about a year of funding for at least one engineer from NASA to do this, and I probably can raise some more little bits and pieces dollars here and there, of building a prototype to show this in a sort of toy way, proving that it can or can't be done in some other abstract way. But I'd rather build the simulation, see if we can run it, see if we can actually steer into the problem space and steer toward and show that we've gotten to more complex self-organization than we would have otherwise, once we had control over those parameters. Because that could be the foundations for much work later. Because the trend in computing is multiple cores. So we're not getting any more CPU speed because of the heat problem. We're getting 8 cores, 16 cores. Intel has a 24-core die in the test rack right now. So conceivably, in 10 years, you might have a 1,000-core machine. In an NVIDIA card, you've already got hundreds of cores. You've got pipelines. The Boink network, the grid network, uses those. If you sign on, you sign into Einstein at home, uses NVIDIA now. So you're taking advantage of these huge number of cores. Carl Sims is working on a 2,000 processor thinking machine, a connection machine that had lots of cores. So think of the future of computing giving you these tools to do this kind of thing. So in a sense, the EvoGrid project is really targeted toward when computing does have access to thousands or even a million cores to do things. So, and this is where, you know, my knowledge is starting to run out and I really need a lot of help, but some of the properties, I do a lot of scribbles, as you can see from the previous slides, trying to come up with things in the imagination where you're trying to simulate space, where you're squeezing, this is a directed graph version of it, you're squeezing and shrinking directed graphs to create longer and shorter paths, to create kind of a simulation of either energy flows or phases of matter or whatever. I built that model last year. It seemed to me that it was too inflexible. But you want to have some of the properties that you're seeing there. And this is where I need a lot of help, because I don't understand what properties are important and how do you quantify them. Of course, here's Harold's memory synthesis. So the one thing I could find on his website, it says, source available soon. I've assembled an advisory group, and they're now passing a whole lot of inputs, like, do you do multi-grid or multi-resolution simulation? Can you afford to do that? The original von Neumann architecture is pretty elegant. It doesn't have any object-orientedness. It's just a gigantic batch processing, and it's sort of appealing from the simplicity standpoint. Chris Langton, when they built Swarm, it was also a giant go-to loop, just going through as many objects as possible, as few indirections as possible. So I mentioned this grid ability, and it has to, of course, be secure if it's running on people's machines at home, so it really it's just a computing box that's sending a frame back after it gets a frame done, if you're doing that kind of treatment of the observer function, if just to avoid the possibility of biasing the simulation by somebody seeing somehow the observer function recording emergent phenomena and all these users going in and observing and biasing the simulation and giving it more information than it should have, it's done offline. So the simulation would hit a clock cycle, dump a frame, and then that would be analyzed somewhere else. So it doesn't affect the computing speed, it doesn't affect, there's a regularity to it. So that was one of the concepts that came from the advisory group. Then I got into this whole belief that maybe it could be done with a gas lattice cellular automata system. So I started doing all these funny drawings. And then, of course, discovered there's a large literature in this, or in large enough literature. So the particles are coming in, and they're aggregating at these points, and they may be hitting a kind of a graviton particle that shoots them this way. So that's a simulation of gravity. You've got the oldest only particles in the system, and there's a particle that emits a gravity impulse, or there may be a particle that says, you're sticky, you can be sticky here, or I am heat. You know, another way of skinning the cat, as we say in English. Perhaps you could also have, you know, crowding models where there are enough particles that the time it takes them to move anywhere gradually gets more and more and more, so you have settling. Or you might have a solid might be where it's pretty much infinity, and they're only moving short distances, so you're simulating part of the space that's solid. So that really the next steps for me is to keep traveling around the world and building up an advisory network, trying to figure out what the best practice, existing core components, maybe like Harold's component, when that little link works and you can download the source code, do all this design, I want to try to get something up this year, working this year. Peter Newman, who's going to be, he's works for Digital Space for the last 10 years, he's going to be the chief architect, getting heavy lifting programming done, starting on March 1st. How does it correspond to, you know, wet chemistry? Does this suggest an eventual bridge between soft and wet A-life? Now, the interesting thing is that there's something interesting here, because if you have these simulated universes with physics sliders, you're actually characterizing in a toy universe way systems that could generate emergence or self-organization. They may never be correspondable to the physical world, but it's an interesting exercise. You could eventually have a continuum where you could say, all along here, you could get lifelike emergence, and over here, it's pretty tough, but it can happen. And so if a universe existed out there somewhere that had these properties, it would have more life in it than ours, or less. Alternately, one of the interesting things for exobiology would be if you in 50 years if you get really good simulators of a billion cores, and you instead of just going to Mars and drilling into the ice cap of Mars, if they did this summer, you would completely characterize and model that ice cap in the simulator and figure out if something could in principle be there. You know, given an understanding of its history of how it occasionally melts and settles and melts and settles, you could actually do predictive simulations of where life might be. And that's an interesting possible application. Another application, this goes back to my asteroid work for NASA and others, is, you know, this and Freeman Dyson about 20 years ago, because he's Freeman Dyson, came up with this idea of, well, you know, life is on the Earth's surface, but frankly, there's a lot more surface than the planets on these small objects, little cometary fragments and whatnot. There's a lot more that's exposed to energy. A lot of it's further out. But the ideal place for life in the solar system is on the surface of those objects. So you ought to worry about evolving or building life-like systems that can live there. Because if you can, in a million years or 1,000 years, when you go out in your space travel, you'll find things to harvest. And that's Freeman, the Dyson's trees idea. And this is, of course, extremely far-fetched and way out there. But, of course, the panspermia idea was as well. And we find out that maybe there's bacteria living in asteroid or crustal material that's been blown off and survived for long periods. It's probably very dormant. It's not redoing anything. But perhaps in if one was to get a free ticket to go to see an extraterrestrial civilization, you might find that their home planet is surrounded by asteroids and they're mining it, and that the small rocky and icy objects in their solar system is just crammed with life, because that's how you do it. You send life out in advance. A metaphor for us is Antarctica. Settlers could come to North America. It was fine. There's breathable air. Earlier peoples came there. There's already biota there. Antarctica, no. Despite the fact there being breathable air, everything is airlifted in. Antarctica is like another planet, effectively, on Earth, with breathable air. That's the only advantage you have. So the philosophical implications might be, the discussion I had with Dawkins was, would you as a biologist, you know, take a career risk, and he's already taken all the risks you could possibly take in a career. Having looked at sort of an annual review of these systems that are showing emergent properties, would you declare them worthy of study as a living system without having to declare them to be a living system? And he said, oh, certainly. So that was interesting. He said mainly because it would help push biologists to define what a living system is. And I've just talked about how could you use an evolution machine, or you have the term living technologies. I'm thinking of a parallel term, evolution technologies, to just describe the use of the power of evolution in software to accelerate and build new creatures and build new drug solutions, etc. One of the spin-offs that could be, if you could build an evo grid-like system, maybe you could simulate entire processes in a cell. Maybe you could experiment with cancer drugs and cancer solutions. If you had built and done all of this, there would be spin-offs if you could build such a system. And of course, how does it, hence the book that just came out, how does it affect our sense of God, place in the universe, and the future of life if we undertook such a large project? So that's evolution technologies. No idea if that will catch on or if that'll be doable, but external advisors currently signed up, informal external advisors, include these fellows, some of the old artificial life people from the old days. I haven't seen to get any touch with Chris Langton, so I have no idea what he's doing. Any of you know, you may or may not be interested. Some of these are some new people with startups in Silicon Valley that are quite interested in the Institute. And prospectively, perhaps people from here, if they're interested in looking at, and anyone else, Harold and possibly Ruby. So that's what I'm assembling on that side of things. And all the resources, such as they are, this needs to be completely redone. The web pages always get done for later. Evogrid.org. The biota is a weekly... what we did in 2005 is we started packaging all of our core conferences, all the audio, and putting it into a podcast, because we realized the community needed that. They needed a facility. And then Tom Barbalay did this, and then Tom started a Blog Talk Radio call-in show that runs every week. Mark Bedeau was on it a month ago, and it's a news mechanism for the whole community. It's really quite something. There's a couple of CDs of about 2 months ago of collected audio. If you want to see the space simulations, digitalspace.com is where all those are, and they're all runnable. And all of our work is open source. It's macro level physics, but it's all Ogre-based. ODE and other engines can be plugged in, and it's all available if we should need such a platform. NASA continues to fund its extension. And most of the funding has come from NASA and some from the NIH for this work. And that's a nice closing thought. A New Yorker cartoon. You can't get better than New Yorker cartoons for you guys. And that's it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Bruce. That was very interesting. It's a bit late. I don't know if you have other commitments, so you it wouldn't be rude if you left now. But Bruce is here all day, so if you'd like to talk with him, there's plenty of time. We'll be going to lunch probably around noon, so you're welcome to join us for that as well.
Questions? Comments?
I have a philosophical one. Here, you came on this biomorphs. Do you have a good definition of whether the biomorph is maybe life or not life?
Oh, I think no one would declare it to be life. I mean, in a sense, it's showing properties it might be observed in a living system, but those were so early, I guess the late 1980s, done on the Apple II or something. When it was on the Macintosh. So I don't think anything...
So that's done from the morphology. But if you go further down and look for molecules, then you might be able to say whether this is really life or not life.
And that is the challenge. So if one was to say, and there's a wonderful book by Ursula Goodenough called The Sacred Depths of Nature, and it's sort of really written in... She's a cell biologist, it's written in poetic style, and she basically frames it really beautifully and says... You know, liquid environments that aren't too hot and aren't too cold, so that the atoms molecules are locked in place are the thing where bonds can form and complexity can emerge. So really focus on that. So really, any simulation is pared down to focus on the liquid environment and things like it. So I believe that showing sort of a surface terrain where creatures are walking, that's way too far off the scale already.
Yeah.
You have to start with the particles. And then you can ask the question of when is it life-like, or when is it a building block, from the book. The building. When is it an authentic building block is there. And you could consider, you could have two different evo grids. You could have an evo grid, call it an evo grid origins, and an evo grid intelligent designer edition, which would allow you to go in and attempt to construct structures that, you know, construct a replicator and have it be in there. And that'd be fine, too. And that it would be the, you know, you're acting, as Douglas Adams said in his speech at Biota 2, you're the artificial god. So that would be possibly a good laboratory tool to come out of that. But what would be interesting is if you had the EvoGrid ID edition and somebody made something that was like a vesicle and they were able to do that, and there was a lot of... millions of people trying to do this in an open evo grid, and they managed to get something to start showing natural selection, showing diversity and whatnot. And then you ran the evo grid origins simulator, and it got there only later. It'd be an interesting thing. Then it would really, what, you know, was God involved in one and not the other? God acted as a result. Sorry?
Which edition did he use?
Which edition did he use? Yeah. That's what the God Detector chapter in the book is about. and there's the next version of the Evo Grid movie, it's called the God Detector version. There's a light bulb screwed on top of the simulator, and God appears behind the simulator, can't stand it anymore, goes in and makes something, and then is detected. So, you know, the fundamentalist God that's controlling every atom. You know, just very restless and very creative and frustrated when things don't go his way. One of the interesting, in the history of computing, of which I am a student, I was just at Bletchley Park, which is where the code breakers in World War II worked. And this is the primordial soup project to the Institute for Advanced Study Machine and everything. And it was totally top secret for 30 years after the war. So nobody knew what they had built, which is a machine called the Colossus. I think it's also called Whirlwind, too. It was the code name. The Colossus was this massively parallel 2,500-valve machine that broke the Lorenz code, which was the highest code. It's like the Navy's highest code. And this was basically so they could read Mr. Hitler's personal email, which they did for 6 months before D-Day. So Mr. Hitler would have his tea, get his dispatches back, and it had already been read by the Allies before he read it. Can you imagine that? And it probably shortened the war by 3 years, and probably prevented atomic weapons from being used in Europe. And that's one of the... It so shortened the war. And after, in the 1970s, when the Colossus Project was revealed out of the official secrets, German high command retiree survivors came to a conference in Britain where they were shown that their communications were being read in real time every day, except for some blackout periods when they added another rotor to their machine, the Enigma machine, and they were just dumbfounded. None of them had ever, the Allies had hit it so well that they did not know that their dispatch was being read in real time. So one of the interesting things is if you were on a convoy trying to get vital supplies to Britain, and you were not flown over and discovered by a German aircraft, even though they knew where the U-boats were, you were doomed, and no one was going to save you, because they could never afford to lose that cover. So as soon as your convoy was overflown, then the command would say, blow up, go and move, or blow the U-boat, because you have to be discovered before. So an interesting cat and mouse kind of a game. But needless to say, you know, Bletchley Park being a British operation meant that they, as soon as the war was over, they destroyed all the stuff, you know, and got rid of it all, and told people not to talk about it for 30 years. So in the mid-70s, the project was revealed, and there was no parts left of this machine, and this guy, Tony Sale, in the late 80s and early 90s, put it in this bonnet to actually build the thing from scratch, and they had five photographs and a couple circuit diagrams and memories of people that had sort of vague memories of this, and they did it. They rebuilt the machine, and it works. They took a code from World War II and they decrypted it last year. And if you want a fun day, go to Bletchley Park, just north of London, and go and see this thing. They have a big computer museum as well, but it's paper tape is with five holes punched in it, is moving around at 30 miles an hour on these. It's going so fast and so tightly that it cuts through aluminum. If they're not careful, it cuts through this hole. It's being read by a photo detector, and it's going through this cascade of, and there's clicking sounds and knock-knock sounds, and it's really quite bizarre, and there's heat coming off the machine. And they shut it down every day, and then they gradually power it, and vacuum tubes are blowing, and there's a big box of blown vacuum tubes. And they have a one-year supply left. So every visitor that comes asks, please, if you find valves in your grandmother's kitchen cupboard, please bring them here. But anyway, this machine, it's amazing to see it because you can see every bit. And the tubes are lighting and you can see the little filaments going on and off. But that was a flow algorithm that they can crack a code in 13 hours that will take a rack of pentiums 45 minutes. So it's not a whole lot of difference in a dedicated machine. So, and that's the precursor to everything else. I don't know why I started telling you all this, but it's fascinating. So any more questions? Oh, I was telling you this. I remembered because in computing and in simulation, the following thing seems to happen. You get
recording this from our notes.
You get these inflection points or break points, could be thought of, where the simulator can now run faster than the thing it's simulating. And this has happened throughout the history of building simulation. So perhaps, in terms of Bletchley Park, the Colossus could run faster than the Wrens or the Ladies, World War II, Ladies that could do their calculation by hand or on comptometers. So it outran them. It outran a huge building of 1,000 women. So that was, one break point. In terms of my work, 3D rendering, now certainly by the mid-1990s could be done faster than an animator could do it, or certainly in real time, i.e. that you could render and write to film, and that's what made it possible to do Toy Story and other things. In terms of physics, rigid body physics simulation, in the last 4 or 5 years, you now can outrun, you can run the simulator faster than the physical model can run at a low-level analog. So our simulated rover, we could run it even faster than the physical rover going down the sandbox slope. There will come a time when chemical simulations do outrun, they cross over, where they outrun really simple chemical systems, they're going faster, so now you can use them as predictive tools. So that's just a thought, that if we keep going up this curve. And when you can run faster than chemistry, you can get a little bit ahead of it, and you can try things out. It just happened in every other field, from car design to simulating electrical grids and whatever. maybe that's what these things are for us. Especially when you have 100,000 processors to play with. Because certainly it's Microsoft Word, when there's 100,000 cores, is probably going to run any faster. So they run slower. So some things to think about in the long stretch of the history of computing and as a tool for science. And why we can't build a moon base, back to my childhood dreams. It turns out that the moon is so harsh, it's a catch-22. You can't, and I learned this from Jack Schmidt, who went to the moon for 3 days and drove over 30 kilometers of cracking rocks and getting all dirty and everything. And he said, look, the temperature is going through the lunar day-night cycle. The surface temperature is as hot as an oven, 400 Fahrenheit, at the peak of the lunar, just before the sun sets on the moon, and then it plummets down to almost cryogenic temperatures at the lunar night. So we always landed equatorially for reasons of energy, but we always landed during, it was a balmy 50 Fahrenheit, and this is Americans, right, so sorry about the Fahrenheit, you know, 10, 15 degrees Celsius to touch. So you're walking along in your lunar boots and they're not melting off the bottom, and you're not picking up that radiant heat, and the vehicle's not picking it up. They actually had to park the lunar buggy in the shade of the lander to let it cool off, because they had these wax boxes that would boil practically with the heat, and then they would park it in the shade when they were going to sleep and it would let the heat off. And so the problem is, after 3 days, all the lunar dust, which is really harsh stuff, it's like sandpaper, is jamming up all their equipment. It's tearing and cutting into, it's a little ninja knives basically, it's called the glutenates. It's cutting their sleeves, it's starting to cut through the layers of their suits. It's inside the spacecraft, it's horrific stuff. And so they're gradually getting equipment failure, and they're like, yeah, 3 days is about the max, so maybe 4 or 5, and it's getting mighty hot, you know, as the sun rises. So the problem with going to the moon and making a sustainable settlement is also radiation events. Just before Apollo 17 launch, there was a huge sunspot cycle. It would have made them really sick. If they had been in transit outside the Van Allen radiation belt, they would have come back really sick, or maybe fatally so. But they missed it. And so you need to bury a habitat for a long-term crew. It needs to be buried in 3 to 4 to 5 meters of regolith on top of it. Or you happen to find a lava tube, you go and park yourself inside sometime. You need to do that, and you need to have consumables, you need to handle the dust problems, etc., etc. So I designed an architecture for NASA headquarters that was lunar teleoperated base construction, where somebody on the Earth would drive all these excavators and bury the hab, and no astronauts involved, ready to make the base. That would take probably 10 to 20 years of trial and error. My brother works as a mine heavy equipment operator in a mine. He drives trucks that carry 300 tons of rock. He drives shovels that are 6 stories high at the top, and the bucket's the size of a school bus to dig out. They blast these benches, and then he fills his truck and drives his truck away. And I, whenever I show him this stuff, and I'm very virtual and he's very physical. He loves to drive the simulators because he can always defeat the virtual geometries. But he just laughs. He says, you have no idea what you're doing, what you're talking about. If you have a robotic piece of mining equipment and they've tried to develop these things, they need a mountain of spare parts. They need a guy in a pickup truck. They need a building next to it where there's guys watching porn DVDs and frozen pizzas. And when the machine breaks, they're coming out there and they're wailing away at it, trying to get it, because it's a robotic miner. It is so hard. It is so hard. And then to actually use the lunar material in your whole smelter, that's like a huge amount of technology. So it's a catch-22. We can't build in space because we need all of human technology there before to actually keep the thing running. You can't have people standing there building it because they won't live. And doing it with robotics is so hard with people who really do it. And effectively, what I think of this as the quality of, I have a 5-acre farm in California, and I've learned we raise pigs, we raise our food, etc. And I've learned that every square meter of that land has a maintenance plan. You know, here in Denmark, things are well maintained, and if you came to my place, you'd probably be pretty horrified. But I could only do so much. But human civilization has put enormous effort into maintenance of its environment. And in space, there's no infrastructure for it. So we're stuck. And we think we have complete control, but leave this, even Denmark, leave it for a year and see how much still works. New York City would flood in 48 hours if they wouldn't be able to pump the subway. So human civilization creates this artificial sense of control and mastery over nature that we really don't have without having an enormous amount of continuous maintenance. So that's why lunar bases aren't coming anytime soon. But thank you for coming.